This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Back in 2009, Julian Castro attended a meeting at the White House. He was the mayor of San Antonio, but apparently he looked pretty young at age 35. They say President Obama thought he was an intern. Well, a few years later, Castro became Obama's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. And in 2012, Castro became the first Latino to give the keynote address at the Democratic National Convention. Now, Castro is 44 and contemplating a run for president. He's speaking to Democratic groups, including recently in Iowa, and he's got a memoir coming out. He writes about growing up with a twin brother, who's now a congressman, being raised in Texas by a single mother and an immigrant grandmother. The book is called An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. We'll talk with Castro about his new memoir and what might be next in his political career after this.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
More than 20 years. That's how long Olympic gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar abused the girls and women who came to see him for treatment. Believed, a new podcast from Michigan Radio and NPR, digs into how he got away with it for so long.
Joining us in studio is Julian Castro. Secretary Castro, welcome to 1A.
It's great to be with you.
Tell me about the title of the book, first of all, Waking Up from My American Dream. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, this is a memoir, and so it's really the story of my family's time in the United States. And it starts with my grandmother, whose name was Victoria, who came over with her younger sister from Mexico in 1922 because her parents had died and her nearest relatives lived in San Antonio. And the subtitle, Waking Up from My American Dream, is really about each generation of my family kind of confronting and figuring out that to make the American dream real, not only do you have to work hard as an individual and a family, but really that you had to do something broader than that, that you had to try and push your community and the country to get better. So in my grandmother's case, you know, she came into a Texas where she would still see signs in storefronts that said, no Negroes, no dogs, or Mexicans allowed. My mother, was the first in her family to graduate from high school and then go on to college. She got very active as a student in the old Chicano movement, the Mexican-American civil rights movement of the late 1960s and early 1970s. And so she tried to improve her community. And then my brother Joaquin and I, jumped into politics full bore. And we've tried in public service to make sure that other folks could have the kind of opportunity that we had going to the public schools there in San Antonio and then getting to go to college, getting to go to law school to become professionals and reach our American dream. And I think that message of waking up is something that I hope a lot of young people will take to heart today, because if there's ever a time where we need to push back against folks and forces who are trying to take us backward, it is today.
Well, and I appreciate you saying that. I did want to clarify the subtitle so that it didn't sound like you were saying that the American dream was some fantastical thing that we need to just wake up from in kind of a cynical way. You talking about, and you write in the book about kind of particularly your mother and her advocacy at the birth of the Chicano movement, how much work went into kind of making this American dream real or more real.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think about the generations whose shoulders we stand on, and in so many different ways, whether it was marching in the streets, picketing, obviously fighting for the franchise, and then actually going to vote and organizing, people running for office, you know, in every different way, either through neighborhood organizations, church organizations, people have fought to improve the opportunities that folks have of every different background. And I think that that's an important message today.
One of the things that I have had to get used to being in Washington is the kind of parlor game of 2020, of who's in and who's out. So let's just get that out of the way. Are you prepared to declare your candidacy?
You know, I'm going to make a decision after November, although I would love to give you a scoop today, Joshua. But
I don't care about a scoop. I just want to know where we're going.
I am, obviously, I've been to New Hampshire twice. I've been to Iowa twice. I'm seriously considering running for president. I'm going to make a decision after the November election and before the end of the year.
What's the biggest variable for you in terms of whether it's a yes or a no in terms of your candidacy?
A couple of things. The first one is personal. My family and I have talked about it, of course, and my wife, Erica, has always been wonderful and very supportive throughout my time in public service. At the same time, there's no question that this is a bigger deal. It's a bigger endeavor than anything that we have done. And so we need to have a longer conversation about that. And then secondly, I'm getting out into the country right now to different states as I help candidates who are on the ballot in 2018, and I'm getting a sense of where the country is at. And I think we'll also get a sense of that in November. I believe that these November elections set a mood. They set a tone for the next couple of years. And there's no absolute rush to make a decision right now.
Yeah, I don't know anybody who doesn't feel like the November elections are going to say something cogent about where the country is right now. I wonder what this process has been like for you of kind of dating the country to see if we want to go steady, like just the process of writing a book and visiting New Hampshire and visiting Iowa, testing the waters. What has this been like for you just on a personal gut level?
Well, I mean, you know, in some ways it's not too different from what you do when you're in politics. You know, I ran for office before I started running for office when I was 26 for city council in San Antonio, and then I became mayor of San Antonio and then served as HUD secretary, and I traveled during my time as HUD secretary in those 2.5 years to 100 different communities. So, you know, it's not very different from that, just talking to people, understanding what their concerns are. At the same time, it's clear when you get out there and people think that you might run for president that they view you differently, right? Because then they're evaluating you as
right.
well in a different way. So that's a vibe, that's a dynamic that is different from before. But it kind of feels natural by now.
Well, in light of that, I did want to ask you some questions about what's kind of going on in the world policy-wise, since we are beginning to kind of get this wooing process underway. We are in the middle of something of an international crisis right now regarding Jamal Khashoggi, this Saudi journalist who has disappeared. The Turks have said or have accused the Saudi government of arranging basically a hit to kill him in retaliation for his journalism. Some members of Congress, current members, are calling for action, including Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio. He was on CNN over the weekend, spoke to Jake Tapper, and was asked how the U.S. should respond if it is determined that the Saudi regime had Khashoggi killed. What should the U.S. do in that regard? Here is part of what Senator Rubio said.
But here's the bottom line. I believe the Trump administration will do something. The president has said that. But if he doesn't, Congress will. That I can tell you with 100% certainty. With almost full unanimity across the board, Republicans and Democrats, there will be a very strong congressional response if, in fact, the Saudis lured him into that consulate, murdered him, cut up his body, and disposed of it. There is going to be a very strong congressional response.
That's Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio speaking this weekend on CNN. Now, I know your experience has been as an executive in government, as a mayor, as a cabinet secretary. The president has said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is headed over to Saudi Arabia now. What's your take on what the U.S. should do?
Well, you know, number one, I hope that our president is taking this matter seriously. To me, in his initial comments, he seemed to be far too flippant and suggested perhaps that because Mr. Khashoggi was not a U.S. citizen, that he seemed to be almost waving this off and not interested in getting to the bottom of what happened. We need to get to the bottom of what happened. And, you know, I'm pleased to hear Senator Rubio talk about Congress taking action. I think that in different ways, Congress has been somewhat AWOL in terms of taking action with regard to this president. And because of this administration's, I think, lack of attention to some of these issues, what we see is the worst impulses around the world of folks coming to bear. And this may be another example of that. And so I think on both ends, at the White House, this president needs to take matters like this more seriously. And in Congress, Congress has a role to fulfill that I hope they will fulfill.
There's also this complicated relationship the U.S. has. And Senator Rubio is Cuban-American. You know, he has very, very strong feelings about totalitarian or heavy-handed governments, considering his family's experience with the Castro regime. But there's also this arms relationship that the U.S. has, this very transactional relationship between the U.S. and the Saudis. As the chief executive of the U.S., as president, how do you walk that line?
Well, you're right that there are different dimensions to the relationship, but let me bring up one dimension to the relationship that I think is useful for folks to ponder right now. The United States needs to become as energy independent as possible in the future. We should not have our fortune or our destiny tied up into, you know, so tied into relationships with countries like Saudi Arabia. There are other dimensions to that relationship, military dimensions and so forth. There may even be, as some have suggested, personal interests that Donald Trump has. We have an unprecedented situation where we have a president who has not divested himself from business interests around the world. And so we don't know what business interests he may or may not have with Saudi Arabia, with other countries, when he makes executive decisions on behalf of the United States. That's very troubling.
Where's the line for you? And I know we have to pause in a moment, but where's the line for you as president when you stand up to the Saudis and say, you know, the economic relationship we have is nice, but our values come into play here? Where's that line?
No, I think our values should always take precedence. The United States has been part of, particularly in the 20th century, in post-World War II, building up an alliance of nations that stood for certain things, stood for democracy, stood for greater freedom, stood for individual liberty. And what we see right now is a scaling back of that.
We'll continue with our conversation with former HUD Secretary and former San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro in just a moment, and we'll get to more of your questions and thoughts as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
The following message comes from our sponsor, Capital One. Would you know if someone applied for credit using your Social Security number? If not, listen to Joe Whitchurch, head of the CreditWise app, talk about the new SSN tracker his team recently released.
While identity fraud is something everyone needs to be worried about, we want to make it easy and seamless for them to become aware of anybody attempting to use their identity without their knowledge or permission.
CreditWise is free for everyone, whether you're a Capital One customer or not. You can find CreditWise in your app or Play Store now.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bishon Clark wrote on our website, the1a.org, what can one say that Julian Castro actually did while at HUD? How did he distinguish himself?
No, thanks for the question. We had the most groundbreaking progress when it came to fair housing during my tenure at HUD, you know, for years, decades. Different Democratic administrations had been trying to get done something called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule. Essentially, this was part of the 1968 Fair Housing Act that said the Secretary of HUD had the obligation to affirmatively further fair housing. The problem was that that had never been put into a rule. And so in 2015, we actually came out with this rule, which put teeth into the Fair Housing Act by requiring cities that got HUD money, basically taxpayer money, to get more serious about ensuring they had equal housing opportunity in their community. And I was very proud of it. Unfortunately, that's one of the things that's been rolled back through Secretary Carson in the Trump administration. A second thing that we did that it was just fantastic for the folks who were able to benefit from it was something called Connect Home. The vast majority of people living in public housing don't have access to the internet at home. And we know that, you know, having internet access at home today is not a luxury anymore. It's a necessity. Folks that are trying to look for a job, kids that are trying to do homework, and so on. And so we actually created a public-private partnership with internet service providers, housing authorities, nonprofits, to extend broadband access to families living in public housing.
Dean tweeted, as past Secretary of HUD, what do you feel is the best way forward for affordable housing, and how is HUD doing on this now?
Well, I wish I could say I have more confidence in the direction of HUD right now. I think what you have over there is a whole bunch of career employees that are dedicated to the mission, that are trying to do the right thing, but a political leadership that is not dedicated to the mission, that wants to blame people for being poor.
You're talking about Secretary Ben Carson.
Yeah, which I completely disagree with. I think they've taken it in the wrong direction. The best thing that can be done is number one, to invest the resources to create more housing that is affordable to the middle class and, of course, to low-income individuals. And up and down the line from the federal level, state level, and local level to do that. And then also to work with the private sector in important ways, for instance, at the local level, to figure out zoning codes and planning codes to make affordable housing more developable.
You spent some time in Iowa. You were in Des Moines last week supporting Democrats there who are running for office. And we know that President Trump's trade policies toward China are really hitting some farmers in Iowa pretty hard. Last month, Iowa's Agriculture Secretary Mike Negg spoke to CNBC about what impact that's having at home.
Well, it's as we head into the 2018 harvest season for corn and soybean out here in Iowa, this escalation of the trade conflict really couldn't come at a worse time. So it is impacting our markets, and that's impacting our farmers. So our farmers understand that there are issues that need to be resolved, particularly with China. But there is no doubt that the retaliatory tariffs are impacting our marketplace, and that's impacting our producers negatively.
That's Mike Negg, the Secretary of Agriculture in Iowa, speaking to CNBC. I wonder if you've been hearing what you've been hearing, rather, from farmers and pork producers and others in agriculture as you're making trips through Iowa and elsewhere. Are some of them okay with the current state of relations in the U.S.-China? Do they understand what President Trump is trying to do and agree? Do they tend to be more opposed? What are you hearing?
Well, I hear a lot of concern, a lot of worry, and folks are also wondering, what's the plan here? I think a lot of folks can believe that we can improve our trade relationship with China, but they think the president has gone about it completely the wrong way in this go-it-alone style, very erratically starting a trade war that is going to hurt Iowa farmers. They're also disappointed in their representatives, folks like Steve King right now, that they feel have sat idly by while the president has done this. Or David Young is another good example out there. And so I heard a disappointment with the leadership of some of those Republican congressional representatives, and also tremendous concern because President Trump is so erratic when it comes to China.
Now, Mike Negg has spoken positively about the newly renegotiated NAFTA agreements between Mexico and Canada. What about the trade deals that the president has been making in his time thus far, particularly if you become president in 2020 and have to enter office with these deals as your starting point?
We should always begin from the premise that we want to ensure that our trade deals are good for American workers. We also want to ensure, of course, that American companies who engage in trade are treated fairly, and that we don't get taken advantage of. And so I don't think folks disagree with that. I think what folks disagree with is how erratic Donald Trump has been. And so, in San Antonio, we actually hosted in 1992 or 93 the signing of NAFTA. And we know that there are states that have benefited more than others from NAFTA. One of the challenges for this president and the next president is to strike trade deals that can benefit as much of the United States as possible. We've seen some of the benefits of trade deals in San Antonio. We've had additional investment from auto manufacturing to a number of other industries, certainly along the border of Texas, logistics and warehousing. So Texas probably has been the biggest beneficiary of that. We always need to look at our trade deals from the perspective of the American worker and how they can benefit.
So what do you say to workers, though, who understand where President Trump is coming from, who say, you know, I appreciate the value of trade, but I see what's happened in my town, how many factories have closed, how many jobs have been lost. I see immigration increasing in the U.S. It just feels, as an American, like the rest of the world is siphoning off the best of trade and leaving people like me to kind of scoop up the dregs and hopefully cobble a life together. What do you say to those folks in terms of the future of trade here?
What I say is that, number one, you know, we need to make the investments so that folks can be successful in this 21st century global economy. We have to be smart, because I do think we can improve these trade deals, these relationships. At the same time, we are far past the point where the United States is just going to close its doors and not be part of a global trade relationship. So the question becomes, how do we ensure that you and your family are well positioned to thrive in this 21st century global economy?
Give me one example of one of those investments you would start working on day one.
No, I would start working on essentially understanding, especially in these hard hit Midwestern communities, understanding the assets of each of those communities. You know, what are the skills that we can invest in folks who live in those communities? What are the industries that may not be located there now that we can actively, along with the private sector, work on getting there? And then how does that relate to each of these trade deals? And the thing is that what's missing from the Trump administration is any kind of thoughtful plan on these things. In fact, even with this latest reboot of NAFTA, it seemed like they were rushing right through the finish line and just cobbled together whatever they could get at the end. None of these things seem to have a plan behind them.
A significant part of your story is obviously an immigrant story. So I want to ask you about immigration policy, particularly because of the significant enthusiasm that Trump supporters have for his stance on immigration, even if not on all of his policies. You write in the book about the difficulties you and other Latino families experienced, kind of struggling families. You worked with poor Americans, homeless Americans, while you were HUD secretary. Give me a sense of what Democrats should be saying to Republicans, to conservatives, to moderates who lean toward President Trump about immigration, especially in light of the concerns over what immigration means to the U.S. What should Democrats be saying?
What folks, I think, whichever party they're a part of, or if they're independent, you know, ought to understand is that the vast, vast majority of immigrants in this country are law-abiding, good people who have made their communities stronger. And that on balance, immigration, not just now, but throughout the history of this country, has contributed tremendously to its forward progress. And the message is that we can both have a sensible immigration policy that continues to allow folks to come to the United States, improve our legal process, and also humanely deal with the 10 or 11 million people who are here who are undocumented, and also have strong border enforcement. Folks should also understand that right now we have some of the lowest numbers of people coming across the southern border than we've had in 40 years. And my hope is that that throughout this debate that we've been having and that we're going to continue to have, that more and more people understand the facts and that some of these misperceptions about immigrants as just criminals or immigrants as just a drain on society, that folks get the facts.
I hate to be a downer, but I think we know that facts ain't worth what they used to be these days. I mean, facts don't necessarily win elections. You got to make an emotional argument to get elected. Then the facts come into play when you make policy. How do you work around that, especially now when people are just so ticked off about everything, that getting them to hear facts often is just not happening?
Yeah, let me say two things. Number one, that's why it's so important in our society to invest in public education, to invest from the very beginning in an educated society. I think all of us want our kids to be able to grow up and have a sense of both history and also be able to find the facts for themselves. That's why it's important that we have a thriving newspaper and media industry, because they help keep us informed and focus on the facts. But then also, let me address your point about emotion. One of the most emotional things that I've heard in the last few months was that audio tape of the little girl who was crying out in that detention center for her mother and her aunt, and thought in that moment that she was going to get to call her aunt, and kept crying out for her mom or her dad. So we ought to make decisions based on facts, but if you're talking about emotion, I don't think that we've seen anything worse than what Donald Trump has done to all of those children who are still separated from their parents. And every night, you know that they're crying in some barren detention center. So, you know, we can go at it either way.
I know we've only got you for a few more minutes. Let's see how we can get through a bunch more questions before we let you go. The Bacon Man tweeted, if Secretary Castro runs for president, will he try to bring the Democratic Party back to center and be a bit more moderate? Or will he ride an extreme left wave, which is where it seems to be going at the moment? I'm asking as a moderate. Let me add to that a little bit of context. Former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, he was in Georgia just over a week ago speaking to a group of Democrats and told them it's time for Democrats to be as tough and dedicated and committed as Republicans. He kind of referenced that line from former First Lady Michelle Obama, when they go low, we go high. Here's what Eric Holder said next.
Michelle says that, you know, when they go low, we go high. No. When they go low, we kick them.
And then a few minutes later, he clarified, saying he didn't mean Democrats need to do anything inappropriate. But I also noted they didn't exactly gasp. They clapped. Like a lot of Democrats feel like, you know, if Republicans won the election by basically punching us in the face and stepping on American values, you know, why the hell are we still playing nice?
Well, and, you know, I'll let kind of Attorney General Holder you know, speak to what he thinks we should do. I would say that you do have this divide out there right now amongst Democrats, some who want this Michael Avenatti style, in your face, give Trump what he gives us, versus folks who want a more hopeful vision for the future in the manner that I think Barack Obama painted 10 years ago. And it's understandable why folks want that, you know, in-your-face style. I do think that we have to stand up for what we believe in. We have to be very forthright and blunt. At the same time, if you look at the history of this country and you look at the Democrats that have prevailed in presidential elections, they painted a hopeful vision for the future of the country. And so I believe that that is the right path ultimately.
Two comments about just your visibility, your name recognition. Black Adder tweeted, yeah, I could vote for a Castro. Might be an issue in the Cuban community in Florida. Different Castros, people, different Castros. Mm-hmm. RSB Sale wrote on our website, I'm glad Texas politicians are getting some of the national limelight. I don't think Beto and Julian are the best examples, referring to Beto O'Rourke, a Democrat who's running for the U.S. Senate in Texas. How is the name recognition game going for you, just in terms of getting people to know who you are and what you're about?
Well, I mean, you know, my brother and I have both been active, of course, in Texas, but now across the country for the last few years. If I decide to run for president, I guess I'll concern myself more about that. Remember that the presidential primary is not a national election. It's a state-by-state primary and caucus election. And so folks need to do the hard work in Iowa, New Hampshire, the other early states, to be able to do well. Of course, raising your name ID nationally, and that leads to your ability to fundraise, is important. But, you know, basically been out there making sure that the folks who are going to get to caucus, if I decide to run, that they get to know me.
One more question I would ask. You mentioned your twin brother, who is a congressman. You talk a lot about him, particularly in the early parts of the book, and how you two were the most competitive twin brothers who ever lived. How has having a twin affected the way you view politics?
That's a good question. I don't think anybody's asked me the question in that way. I would just say, you know, what's interesting about being a twin is that everybody sees you the same way, right? Like you're part of a package. You're a group deal, a package deal. And I guess it's helped me to understand issues of identity and how people think about themselves in politics because I grew up and everybody saw me as part of somebody else.
Julian Castro, the new book is called An Unlikely Journey, Waking Up from My American Dream. Secretary Castro, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.